Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate. This is going to sound more high-minded than I mean it to, but which came first, the government or the economy? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 19th of July. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. While there are, of course, significant policy differences between the Republican and Democratic parties on almost everything, if your remit is business and economics, as is ours, those differences kind of boil down to how much the government ought to be involved in the economy. Generally speaking, Republicans say less so, Democrats say more so. And that gets me to the news out of the White House today, the, of course, Democratic White House. The Biden administration making the latest announcement in its efforts the past couple of years to crack down on what it says is too much concentration and anti-competitive behavior in too much of this economy. From the Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Justice, we got new guidelines on mergers and acquisitions. From the Department of Housing and Urban Development, new research and private sector changes to junk fees and the rental market. And from the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, a new plan to address accusations of, and this is a quote from them, price gouging and other anti-competitive practices in the food and ag markets. That last one, obviously, has been a big deal the past couple of years as food inflation has run so hot. And as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, the fight over just who is responsible for those high food prices right now is still going strong.
The Biden administration's argument echoes the complaints of many advocates, both for consumers and for some farmers. Joe Maxwell is president of the advocacy group Farm Action Fund.
That means the dominant firms in any of the food and agriculture sectors, the control that they have over the market, has provided them the ability to literally set the price as high as they want or gouge in pricing. That has led to the inflation.
Just a few firms control much of the supply chain between farms and our tables, and many of them had record profits even as consumers struggled with higher food prices. The Biden administration says it will work with states to ramp up enforcement of antitrust and consumer protection laws, targeting alleged price fixing in everything from meat processing to grocery store pricing.
They see it as their role to put pressure on corporate manufacturers and processors to try to not only lower inflation, which is good for everybody.
Amy Bentley, professor of food studies at New York University.
But also help consumers bottom line by urging or providing carrots or sticks to corporations to get them to lower their prices.
But those corporations argue market forces are enough to keep prices in check because, you know, this is how capitalism works.
Supply and demand still rules the day.
Curtis Dubé is chief economist at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. He says it's pretty clear that many of these rules and regulations and initiatives coming down the pipeline are going to end up in court.
The Biden administration is making it clear that they are going to be more active intervening, and that the business community or those businesses that are impacted are going to argue for their claim from their side.
Which means this food fight is just getting started. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, on this Wednesday, in mid to late July, I mean up again, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Along with the record heat in much of the country is coming record air conditioning use and thus electricity demand. And as the planet heats up, More of us are turning to home improvements, installing heat pumps or adding insulation to help lower the amount of energy needed to keep our homes cool. And this summer, the federal government's making billions of dollars available to help homeowners make some of those changes, as Marketplace's Elizabeth Troval reports.
One way to think about home weatherization is to think about lunch. Would you rather carry it in a cooler or a paper bag?
If you bring it in just a paper bag, it's going to be warm by lunchtime.
Carisol Rinaldi is with the Building Performance Association and says insulation is kind of like turning your house into a cooler.
If you have insulation and you're air sealed your house and it's well insulated, then it's able to maintain that temperature. You don't have to keep cooling it over and over and over again.
But doing that isn't cheap, which is where the expanded tax credits in the Inflation Reduction Act come into play.
So there's a $1,200 yearly tax incentive for insulation, air sealing, energy audit.
More than double what the government used to cover. Tax credits will also cover up to $2,000 for heat pumps. Kristen Haggerty with the Interstate Renewable Energy Council recently had one installed in her Massachusetts home.
In the summer, they will remove the heat from my house and just move it to the outside, right? And then in the winter, it's the reverse.
She says her overall energy usage has decreased by more than half since installing the heat pump. But tax credits require people to pay thousands of dollars up front. Will Bryan with the Southeast Energy Efficiency Alliance says upcoming state-administered rebate programs will address this.
And there are specific carve-outs for low-income households that I think are designed to overcome some of the barriers that many low-income households face, and you know, particularly just a lack of upfront capital.
He says more efficient homes will make heating and cooling cheaper for everyone. I'm Elizabeth Troval for Marketplace.
A couple of weeks ago, Matt Levin did a story about all the benefits that artificial intelligence might bring to the business of law. The nonprofit California Innocence Project is starting to use AI to sort through stacks and stacks of documents looking for evidence that could free the wrongfully convicted. Big national firms are already deploying AI specifically trained on the law to save them time and, in theory, their clients' money. You get the picture, right? But if that is the upside, surely there's a downside? Here's Matt again.
Caritha Perry has been a paralegal for more than 20 years, mostly with a legal division in the Army. Generative AI really wasn't on her radar until a couple months ago when she took a continuing education workshop. Her instructor had ChatGPT up on the classroom projector. She told it she wanted song lyrics that were some blend of Madonna and Stephen King.
I started creating the Stephen King-ish Madonna song. It was good. It was good what it was typing, you know.
Most amazing was just how fast the AI was writing all of this.
And I just thought, this is replacement. This would replace Madonna. This would replace the Stephen King. This is going to replace a lot of people.
Including maybe her. Paralegals don't typically spend their days creating Madonna, Stephen King mashups, but a lot of Perry's job is writing and research, looking up a statute or case law, seeing if it's relevant to what her boss wants, drafting a brief about it. Tasks new legal AI tools are pretty good at. Her boss has joked with her about this.
He said, well, I just open up the software, I type in, I want cases, statute. I've got it instantly. No need for you.
A recent Goldman Sachs analysis estimated that 44% of work tasks in the legal industry could soon be done by AI. Of course, that 44% number is just a guess. Toni Marsh is a lawyer who runs George Washington University's paralegal program. She doesn't think paralegals will go the way of travel agents or VCR technicians.
They'll just do more stuff, right? So if it takes me 2 hours to do a brief instead of four, then I'll just write two briefs in a half a day instead of one.
Marsh is already tweaking her curriculum for next semester to incorporate AI. Maybe more talking about a legal argument, less actually writing that argument.
Because now with ChatGPT, everybody turns in these, you know, these perfect five paragraph essays that are structurally sound. So that's something that I no longer need to teach them.
While paralegals will likely be on the front lines of the AI revolution, lawyers are also worried. Attorney Stephen Wu at Silicon Valley Law Group was around for previous technological leaps like the PC and the internet. Those made lawyers more efficient and did not result in fewer lawyers.
But I think in this case, what we're talking about is creating more jobs for companies that are the vendors to law firms rather than the law firms themselves.
And while Wu thinks AI is going to make some aspects of a lawyer's job far easier, in the next few years, certain parts are going to be a lot tougher. You know, like proving reality.
You may be an opponent of evidence where the other side is trying to introduce something that is an actual deepfake and trying to pass it off as something real. And then you have the flip side where you're the proponent of the evidence where the other side claims it's a deepfake and it's real.
Photographs, videos, audio recordings, AI is getting really, really good at generating those. Let's say you claim you have a recording of a certain high-profile public radio host confessing to a crime.
You know those mattress tags that say, don't remove under penalty of law? I can't stop ripping those off. I sneak into mattress stores in the middle of the night and just go nuts.
Okay, so that doesn't sound exactly like Kai, but I whipped it up in like half an hour on an AI voice cloning service that costs $5 a month, and that tech is just getting better.
Give it 2 months. Give it 3 months.
Hani Farid is an expert in digital forensics at UC Berkeley. He says he's already getting contacted by law firms to help verify that multimedia evidence is not deepfaked. Farid does a lot of pro bono work, but for his paying clients...
I charge $1,000 an hour. I cost what an expensive lawyer costs. I can only take so many cases, and there's only a handful of us who work at this level.
So while AI might save time and money on some legal work, it could make authenticating basic evidence much more expensive. The good news is Farid thinks this will be more of a temporary problem than a forever one. Watermarking both AI and real recordings will eventually solve a lot of it. But until that happens, things in the judicial system are going to get messy.
This is not AI. This is the real Kai. And I just want to say I promised Matt Levin last year I would give him a huge, huge raise. This is a legally binding promise.
Think that'll hold up in court? I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
You're dead to me, Levin. Dead to me. To be clear, he told me about the mattress part, not that last part. Anyway, coming up.
We are already getting ready for the holidays.
Christmas in July, First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 109, about 0.3%, closed at 35,061. The NASDAQ added 4 points, next to nothing, really, 14,358. The S&P 500 up 0.25%. 45 and 65, Matt Levin. Following up on the food fight that Kimberly was telling us about, let's check in on how some supermarkets are doing, shall we? Albertsons picked up 0.2%. Costco Wholesale added 0.1%. Carvana reported results more than 2 weeks early, and it is no secret why. The used car retailer sped past analyst earnings estimates. It also announced a deal to reduce its debt by more than $1 billion with a B dollar. Shares in Carvana added just over 40%. Goldman Sachs, check this out, did not have a terrific quarter. Reported profits were down almost 66.0%. And yet, because capitalism, as Kimberly said, ticker symbol GS grew just shy of 1%. You're listening to Marketplace. Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Here's one from the Marketplace desk of How Bad Do You Want It? Chipotle says a fifth of its new restaurants, 20%, are going to be in places with 40,000 people there or less. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looks at why some big brands are looking to go small.
Tim Powell still remembers when he was younger and a Starbucks finally opened near his hometown in Ohio.
We were so happy. We were like, oh, I didn't care. It was like 30 minutes away. So, oh, sweet, I got to have that coffee.
Powell is a consultant at Food Service IP. And he says even today, some chains create this kind of buzz, especially among younger people. He says Chipotle is one of them.
It's almost like a lightning rod. You know, it's not Taco Bell. You know, it's not the dudes living with their parents in the basement. I mean, this is Chipotle. I got a 15-year-old daughter that spends our money, a lot of it, at Chipotle.
Trendy chains like Chipotle, Domino's, and Cava have been expanding out into smaller suburbs and even rural towns, says Morningstar analyst Sean Dunlop.
To some extent, a lot of restaurants are just following consumers wherever the consumers are.
Where they are is increasingly away from cities since the pandemic and hybrid work came into play. That's created a lot of communities where, per capita, the number of restaurants is low. Plus, for businesses, labor and rent cost less in small towns.
And so on balance, the economics for a lot of these stores are very competitive.
But it doesn't mean it's easy. Alex Suskind, a professor of food and beverage management at Cornell, says hiring is still pretty difficult and managing supply chains is tricky.
You need to make sure that your trucks can reach those remote locations. And so that takes a lot of planning and rerouting, and you might need additional warehousing.
Which is especially hard for chains that make most of their food fresh on site. As for communities, Suskin says chains moving in is a mixed bag. It boosts jobs and brings in more revenue, but takes away from independent businesses.
It really is a fixed pie. You can't eat in two restaurants at the same time.
And with rewards points and other perks, consumers are incentivized to pick the brand name. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
The electric vehicle revolution is coming, and with it, slowly, very slowly, but surely, the EV charging revolution is coming too, not though before the end of gas stations. But moving on from places where you can pull up and pump 15 gallons into your tank isn't as simple as just closing them down and selling them off. You got to consider what's on that land, or under it more like. Most gas stations have a couple of 3 10,000 gallon storage tanks buried underground, tanks that inevitably leak. The first generation of underground tanks went bad back in the 1980s, leading to some disastrous spills and not, as you might imagine, cheap to clean up. Kate Yoder wrote about the once and future challenges of old gas stations. She is a staff writer covering climate for Grist. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start in the 90s-ish with a bunch of new regulations that oblige gas station owners to replace these big underground tanks. Those tanks have a lifespan of 30 years. And oh, look, here we are.
Yeah. So, yeah, the tanks that were installed in the 80s and 90s are starting to get older. And many of them are approaching the 30-year warranty when experts say that they're likely to leak again. So today, big leaks are rare, but they still do happen. There is better technology available now to prevent leaks, you know, like double-walled tanks with better monitoring. But I found that more than 40% of gas stations aren't meeting all the safety standards to prevent leaks. And, you know, there's 145,000 fueling stations all over the country. And so with states not enforcing all these regulations, that just increases the chance of a disaster.
Who then is on the hook to clean these up? Before we get to what happens to these gas stations, present day, we've got a leaking problem. Who pays the bills?
Well, to be honest, the question of who pays to clean up the contamination is kind of a mess in itself. In theory, station owners are supposed to pay, but sometimes the leak happened before they owned the station, or they're unable to pay, or they're long gone. So then lawyers get involved. And depending when the leak happened, it might fall on an insurance company or an oil company or the government. You know, states deal with cleaning up gas stations in different ways. Often they have funds that oil companies pay into, but sometimes some of these costs get transferred to the public. So in states like Indiana and Tennessee and Arizona, they've actually shifted the responsibility for cleanups to taxpayers through like a small tax on gasoline in most of those places. And honestly, sometimes the answer is that no one cleans it up. These abandoned lots just sit around and developers don't really want to touch them.
And so that land just sits there because it's toxic and contaminated and expensive to clean up. And so it just turns into a brownfield.
Exactly.
What happens now as we, oh so very slowly, electrify transportation in this economy and people stop buying eventually, right? This is a very long run issue here. Stop buying gasoline.
Well, you know, gas stations have some different options for their future. But there was one analysis a few years ago that found between a quarter and three quarters of gas stations could be unprofitable by the early 2030s.
By the early 2030s? That's like tomorrow.
I know. That analysis was done in 2019, and that was even before like all the recent policies we've seen around promoting electric vehicles. So like these stations could be going out of business in a really big wave potentially. Even though, of course, some are going to be around for a long time because we're still going to have gas-powered cars on the road for a while.
Right. But the ones that go out of business, those tanks are going to stay there, and sure, maybe they'll drain them, but the expense of digging them up and cleaning things up is going to be prohibitive.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think people kind of assume all these gas stations are just going to turn into electric vehicle charging stations, right?
Yeah, that was literally my next question.
Oh, that's great. But yeah, it's not actually that simple because most people charge their vehicles at home or maybe while running longer errands because it kind of takes some time to charge up. So I do think that the decline of gas stations that we're going to see is one of the benefits of switching to electric vehicles that no one really talks about. Like, we don't have to have these thousands of tiny toxic waste sites all over our cities and neighborhoods.
Kate Yoder, she covers the climate at Grist. Kate, thanks a bunch. Appreciate your time.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
We got the latest on retail sales yesterday, as you know, up, but not as up as everybody had been guessing. And while consumers are still spending at retailers, there is the small matter of at least one more interest rate increase coming from the Federal Reserve. So some small businesses are having kind of a hard time getting customers in the door. And that was our cue to put a call in to Annie Lang Hartman. She runs Wild Letty. It's a stationery and sundry store up in northern Michigan. We wanted to hear how the summer's been treating her so far.
Even with foot traffic being kind of funky this year, we are still doing really well as far as sales. Foot traffic for the last few months, it's definitely on an upward swing for Northern Michigan. Our busiest couple weeks of the year are the end of July to the beginning of August, so we are headed into that. This year has been kind of odd. We've had some record-breaking days followed by really, really slow days, which isn't typical for tourism in Northern Michigan, so we've just been trying to ride that wave. We have three physical retail locations. Our Fishtown store is up 10%, and our Sutton's Bay store, which we added to our footprint of that location this year, that is up 245%, which is just wild. And then we added a sister store in Sutton's Bay, and this is our first year with it open. We opened Summer Camp, which is the name, Memorial Weekend, and that's been doing really, really well.
I know it's just mid-July, but we are already getting ready for the holidays, kind of working on our marketing plan for online sales. We're focusing on how to drive traffic to our website to capture sales for the holidays already. As far as the rest of our summer, we are looking forward to some really fun events that are going on in both Leland and Sutton's Bay, and making sure that the stores look great and they're stocked and they're staffed. And we are just really excited to get through these next few busy weeks and get ready for Christmas already, which feels really, really wild to us.
That's Annie Lang Hartman, the owner of what is now three branches of Wild Letty up in northern Michigan. We would love to hear your stories, no matter where you work or where you are. Tell us about your economy, would you please? You can do that at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, the latest in our occasional series, Hey, You Think Inflation's Bad Here? Check out the UK. Mitchell Hartman did a story for us the other day, I think it was Monday, about how high, relatively speaking, inflation is in the rest of the world. Well, we got to update the UK's numbers. The Office of National Statistics over there announced this morning that year-on-year inflation in June was a relatively mild 7.9%. I say relatively because in May, prices were going up at an annual clip of almost 9%. All right, we got to go. Here's your moment of economic context, which comes with the observation that I added my 15 bucks or whatever it was to the new Tom Cruise Mission Impossible movie box office take last night. Too long, dragged in the middle, some plot holes, but I mostly enjoyed it as my quick review. Don't at me. Anyway, predictions for the Barbieheimer opening weekend box office palooza are starting to roll in. Barbieheimer, it's tough to say. You try it. Anyway, CNBC is reporting Barbie could bring in $140 million. Oppenheimer as much as $60 million. Hollywood, take my money. I'm going to go see both of them. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Justin Duller, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Risnell. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Khreis, host of This is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.